supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a violet experience for you today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll talk about those ephemeral wild violets and whether it might be possible to enjoy them indoors. And we're going to give equal time to African violets in an interview with some folks from the Gesneriad Society. That's a lot to do, so let's hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Keith, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being had, Keith. Where are you, man?
I'm in Wichita, Kansas.
What can we do for Keith in Kansas, in Wichita?
Yeah, well, I'm actually starting up a container garden here pretty soon, and I know you are king of container gardens. I'm going to have about 3 feet by 3 feet of space, and that's really all the space that I have, and I'm looking for really the most bang for my buck there with what I plant here this coming season.
Once you get to a certain area, a raised bed is really the same rules as a container. You know, nice light soil, a really well-defined area. Wichita, you have a slightly short growing season, but not tragically. What do you want to grow? What do you like to eat and or look at?
Well, I'm a big fan of tomatoes and peppers. Mostly I like to make my salads interesting.
Okay. And you're talking about sweet peppers or hot peppers or both?
Oh, both.
Okay. So what I want you to do when you buy your plants is select small fruited sweet peppers. Now, you see these in the supermarket all the time, the bag with like 20 or 30 tiny miniature sweet bell peppers in it. These plants are super easy to grow, and they produce their peppers, I'm going to say 6 weeks ahead of the typical big blocky pepper you see in the supermarket. They take a long time to grow. You might not even be able to get them to grow to ripeness, whereby you'll be picking and eating little baby bells like jingle bells in late July, and they take up a lot less room, and they don't need much support. 3 by 3 is kind of tight. Now, are you going to try to grow big tomatoes or small tomatoes?
Probably cherry tomatoes or Roma, if I can get away with it.
I would say that if you do this correctly, you can certainly get 2 determinate tomato plants. You want to make sure they're, quote, determinate. That means they're only going to grow to 4 or 5 feet tall, and they're going to be relatively well-behaved. They still need support, but they don't need the kind of big tomato cage that I generally talk about. And you put those kind of opposite each other on like a triangular mode, you could probably fit in 4 pepper plants besides that, 2 little bells and then 2 hot pepper plants. And then the cherry tomatoes, I would say, you must have some place in your landscape for a hanging basket, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So if you want cherry tomatoes, plant them in hanging baskets. Get real big hanging baskets. And don't get the ones that use the coconut shell, the core, or the peat moss for the liner. Mm. You want hard plastic because the other ones are very attractive looking, but they dry out in like 2 hours. So you spend your entire summer watering them, and those Kansas summers get hot.
Yes, they do.
And you know what I would suggest? Is there an area around the raised bed that won't be raised but still has dirt?
Yeah. Right now it's covered in sand, but I'm planning on removing that sand and filling it in with dirt.
Okay, because I was going to say, you know, in Wichita you are socially obligated to grow some sunflowers, you realize.
Yeah, I have a spot on the side of the house for that.
Okay, good. Because, again, I'm going to urge not the giant oil-filled sunflowers that are ginormous and have the, you know, the head as big as a car grill. I'm talking about the little ornamental sunflowers. They're really great. And they would do double duty. They would attract pollinators to the area. Sunflowers are great attractors of bees and beneficial insects and stuff.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
And if you got a little bit of room left over in the bed, don't be afraid to put an herb or two in there.
Yeah, I like basil and oregano. Those are definitely on my always grow list every year.
Okay, yeah, and I think you can get away with that in a 3x3 bed. The secret for your success here is to choose plants that are going to stay small, the garden equivalent of a dwarf fruit tree, for instance. The tomatoes are going to say determinant, bush, container, patio style, and all you have to do with the peppers is stick with the small fruited ones.
Awesome. Thank you very much for the advice.
All right. Good luck, Keith.
Thanks. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Jim. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I almost consider it a neighborhood, but it is a separate address right outside the city of Philadelphia, just like kind of past the northeast.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a great area. I have some dear friends there. What can we do for Jim in Huntington Valley?
Well, Mike, the other thing that seems to like the area is a weed, the fig buttercup.
Okay. Sorry, Jim. We're a little short tonight. We got to go. Thanks for calling. Bye.
Bye.
No, just teasing you, Jim.
Yeah, it's a beast. That's your point, I think, and it's hard to control. But my real problem is my neighbor is considering applying some kind of nasty chemicals to try to control the fig buttercup. And
it's not going to work. One thing to even start to block him is ask him if the chemical herbicide that he intends to use is registered for use on this plant, because I can virtually guarantee it isn't.
Okay.
I don't think there is an herbicide that is registered for use against the, quote, fig buttercup. Like wild violets, it is almost immune, and one of the reasons is the conditions it grows in. So this is a very moist area you have?
Yep, you got it.
Yeah, this is well, to some people it's unnatural, but this is a very natural plant of wet areas. And just think about herbicides in the basic physics 101 sense. When you spray them on a dry plant, there's a strong possibility they're going to have a negative effect on the plant. The effect is going to be total. You spray them on a plant that's essentially almost floating in water, and everything is diluted, and the plant has these endless kind of liquid resources to always minimize the effect of the herbicide. Plus, then the herbicide gets into the water, starts killing frogs and toads and lightning bugs, but not this plant. That's guaranteed. Now, is it in a wild area or is it encroaching on his lawn?
Yeah, it's in both of our lawns.
And your lawns lead into a little wetland or something like that?
It's a little wet in the back. You know, I figured that a French drain would probably what it would take to really help address the conditions back there. But they're both really wet, particularly in the beginning of spring.
Okay. Well, you know, in the beginning of spring, and please, I'm serious, try to convey this to him. In that area that he dislikes, frogs and toads and lightning bugs are breeding like wild. Those frogs and toads will eat their own weight in insect pests every day. And, of course, who doesn't like lightning bugs? You live in a great neighborhood to have lightning bugs in the summertime. And it's very easy to control mosquitoes back there by spreading some BTI granules or dunks around. And you are on to the right track. I don't know of any weed, really, that you should attack directly. What you want to do is change the conditions. A French drain, drain tiles, a more appropriate term for a big outdoor area. Yes, any area that you can divert the water from and let it naturally dry out, then these plants can be dug up and they won't return. Or they may die out naturally because they need excessive amounts of moisture. If the conditions are correct, and you'd have to have somebody look at this, even core aeration this fall, pulling plugs out of the lawn back there to relieve the soil compaction and help it drain better. But that's your long-term answer. Now, is there a Maginot line right now where the buttercup stops and the lawn is a real lawn?
I would say yes, there is. Towards the back of both of our properties, along kind of the fence line there, it's more wet. And as you get closer to the house, it dries out and the grass is still more present.
Right. And so you see the classic example of the grass can outcompete this weed unless the wetness is contributing to the health of the fig buttercup. And it makes it impossible for the lawn to survive because its roots can't get air and dry out. So one thing I might suggest, you can stop the advance by driving in deep edging. And if you wait to do that during a dry period, you may be able to push it back a little bit naturally. And it'll make a more formed look to the lawns. And then you can try to drain those areas. But I got to tell you, those naturally wet areas in the spring, those vernal ponds, they are incredibly valuable for wildlife and for our survival as a species.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted a nice area, organic area for my baby daughter to run around and not be exposed to these types of chemicals. So thanks a lot, Mike. I appreciate the advice.
Oh, good luck, Jim, man.
All right. Appreciate it.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Easttown Library in Berwyn, PA, on Wednesday evening, May 3rd at 7 p.m. Then I'll be at the Green Garden Fair in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, on Saturday, May 6th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be back with Violets, Wild, and African, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hard-working hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, I hope lots of you have wonderful wild violets around that you're enjoying and eating. What can you do, however, if you're renting and your landlord hates them and wants to kill them before the show is over? We'll discuss growing violets indoors a little later on. We'll also take more of your fabulous phone call. But now it's time to give equal time to a very different kind of violet. All right, as promised, it is time to welcome our special guest from the Gesneria Society, which I believe I'm actually pronunciating correctly. Mary Schaefer is a board member and treasurer of the National Gesneria Society, and Betsy Godshall is on the board of directors for the society. Ladies, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for being had. Now, Mary, you'll get us started by explaining what the devil gisneriad means. We were talking before. It sounds like a sneeze.
It sounds like a disease. And that's one of the problems. It's a family of plants. The one that's probably best known is the African violet. The scientific name for that is St. Paulia. And then some of the other
plants. Is it from Minnesota as opposed to Africa?
Absolutely. No, it's from Africa. Actually, from Tanzania. That's where African violets or St. Paulias are. But they're beautiful plants. They're house plants, and they are not that hard to grow.
Take us to darkest Africa or brightest Africa. And we're going to see these plants in their original home. What do they look like? What are they doing? I know that they can't be exposed to direct sun in the summer. So are they understory plants in the wild?
In the wild, they grow in the forest with very little soil. They're in crevices in the mountain and in high shade, not that much sun.
So they're like natural rock garden plants.
Exactly.
I presume, you know, if they're not from Minnesota, St. Paul must have stumbled upon these plants growing in Africa.
No, the name comes, it's from an interesting phenomena. There was an explorer who went to Africa and found the African violets and supposedly sent them back to his father in Germany. These plants came to the United States, not through Minnesota, but actually through Europe. And he sent them back to his father, and their name was Baron St. Paul. But African violets, the late 1880s in Africa, they made their way to Europe. And then after the turn of the century, they came into the United States, a company called Royal and Asticot. And they crossed the species, and they came out with what was called the first 10. And sometimes you'll hear talk about the top 10 or the first 10 violets. And they were very different than what you think of as an African violet today. You know, different types of little purple flowers, but still they took over the world, so to speak.
I was going to say, were they hot right out of the box?
They were hot right out of the box. And in fact, even though we know African violets today, they are, I would say, a lot less popular today than they were, 40 years ago.
Right? How many different color variations would you say there are? Because I can't think of any colors of African violet that don't exist.
Orange doesn't exist.
Orange doesn't exist. Is that something?
I'm having a very difficult time getting a yellow African violet.
Oh, okay.
A true yellow.
Right, like a true black tulip, which is actually dark purple.
Right.
Well, some of them blush yellow, and they get all excited, but then when they continue to grow it out, it loses its yellow blush and becomes just a white violet again.
You know, I don't think that's unusual in the plant world. One of the things I enjoy watching with the flowering crab apple in my driveway is when it first puts on its buds, you'd swear you're going to get red flowers. They're blood red.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And then as they begin to open up, they become more pink. And by the time they drop down and cover the driveway, they're bone white.
I believe the African violet species, they're not as showy as the violets that most people know. But I think if you grow a lot of violets, it's almost your obligation to grow a few of the species. Because if we don't grow them, they're not going to last in
nature. You're talking about the original African violets.
The species, the ones that come true from seeds.
Right. Which we talk about with tulips all the time.
Do you? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Species tulips are so much easier to grow than the crazy hybrids. And they're important because, as you may know, a lot of species tulips were lost during World War II when people had to eat the bulbs to survive in Holland.
Yeah. The species violet, they're not grown that often. It's hard to get them commercially. You more or less have to grow them from seed. They're a little finicky if you're trying to grow them like you're growing your regular violets because they need a little less light, a little tighter pot. But I think they're beautiful.
So really, that's the master class when you start growing your own plants from seed.
Or when you start to hybridize and take two of those species and cross them, or take a hybrid and cross it with one of the species to make it a healthier plant.
Now, would this be as simple as growing species A out from seed, growing species D out from seed when they're in flower, transferring the pollen, and then taking the seed that comes off of those flowers and planting it to see what you got?
Exactly.
And we insist that a plant grow through several generations before we can name it a hybrid that is worthy of keeping.
And registering.
Right, so you can be sure it's going to be true.
Yes.
These plants are so popular. And if you care for them correctly, they're probably among the easiest care houseplants. But I think where people go wrong is two ways. People always equate lots of bright light with plants.
Right.
And as we said, these are understory plants in the wild. They want bright light, but never direct sun. They'll literally wash out, right?
Mm-hmm. If you give them too much light, it's just like you'll get sunburned. You know, if you get too much light, they may bloom, but you also can end up with spots on your leaves.
And then there is the classic that even though I've been in this profession for like 30, 35 years, I always have to laugh when I read it. Keep the growing medium constantly moist, but never waterlogged.
Right.
And it's like, what?
Right.
That's, you can't do that. You know?
So the way that most African violets are killed by far and away is by watering them too much. If you're going to give them too little water rather than too much water. Water the plant, water it thoroughly till the water comes out the bottom, and then let it dry out till when you touch the top of the plant, it feels dry.
Is there any place in America where people could grow African violets as outdoor plants in the right conditions?
There's no place in North America where people could grow African violets outdoors unless they put it out and brought it in the winter. However, there are a few hardy other jasnariids. But one of the things that I grow outdoors in the summer anyway, here in, you know, the Northeast, is syninges. Now, if you go a little further south, people will grow some of the syninges that are hardy. They'll leave them outside.
Now, describe the plant.
So syninges come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. They come mainly from Brazil, and they have a tuber, which is like a bulb, if you will, and you put it in the pot. Sometimes the tubers like to be outside the pot. They'll push themselves up so that the tuber...
Like irises and amaryllis.
Okay. They get beautiful flowers. And the nice thing about that, with the plant grows from a tuba, is just like, you know, plants with a bulb, they die down. So if you have a bad year, the foliage got ratty, whatever your story was, it'll come back next year and you get to try again.
Now, one of the things you wanted to get done while you were here on the show is to talk about a free webinar you have up on your website called Meet the Family.
Right.
That I presume will introduce you to the wide world of gesneriads.
So the website is gesneriadsociety.org, G-E-S-N-E-R-A-I-D, society.org. And on there we have a section called The Shop, and we have webinars in there. We have a program now. We probably have 12 or 14, and we're continuing to create new ones. And the idea is that these programs, you can listen to them in your own home, or if you're in some sort of a gardening group, it's a one-hour program. You could have it as your program. And we also have one that's free because we want people to try it. Sometimes people, if they're not working in the business world, they haven't been exposed to webinars, and we want them to feel comfortable. So we have Meet the Family. It's free. It introduces the plants.
Obviously, it starts with African violets. And then let's hear about some other family members.
So I talked a little bit about syninges. We do that. The big popular one for us anyway is Streptocarpus.
It sounds like a disease,
but they are beautiful plants. And in fact, that was our first webinar, and it's probably been the one that people have watched the most.
Well, talk about the plant.
Fibrous root, long leaves like the tongue of a dog.
Yes.
And the flowers are exquisite and come in multi colors, and it's an easy plant to grow.
Okay, but an indoor plant, a house plant.
An indoor plant again, yes.
All right. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I'll remind our listeners that if they want to get started in this world, there is a free webinar called Meet the Family at the Gesneriad Society website. That's gesneriadsociety.org. And we've been speaking with mostly Mary Schaefer and a little bit with Betsy Godshaw. Both are on the board of directors for the National Gesneriad Society. Ladies, thanks so much for sharing your knowledge here on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for having us, and thank you for doing such a great show.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Betsy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Betsy. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm in the studio, Bets. Now, where are you well?
Well, the house we're talking about is in Altoona.
Oh, okay. Altoona, PA. What can we do for Betsy, not personally in Altoona, but who apparently has some plants there?
Right. I'm about to inherit my grandparents' house. They built a mid-century modern place way back when, and they did a wonderful job putting a landscape together, and the garden at this time of year is extraordinary. And one of the things that they put in the landscape was a cluster of blue spruce trees. But they're now, 50-some years old at this point, and the bottom half of them, they're probably like four stories tall, the bottom half of them are pretty much free of needles. So as I'm about to inherit this property, I think the right thing to do is to probably take down those trees. However, everybody loves these trees, including me, and I was hoping to find a way to propagate them so that everyone can at least have one of Grandma and Grandpa's trees, even if we can't really keep the originals. So how do we propagate trees?
Well, first of all, I don't think you need to cut down these trees.
Oh, all right.
It is very common for these kind of evergreens to lose their lower branches as the trees grow and shade the lower branches. You often do see blue spruces that have a skirt that goes all the way to the ground, and it's a remarkable effect. But those are almost always what are called specimen trees. They're planted alone. They're getting sun from all sides. Once these trees grow large enough to start shading each other, it's very natural for the bottom branches to turn brown, to lose their needles. The key to the health of the trees is in the canopy, is in the growing tips. If that still looks good up there, these trees have a lot of life left in them.
Okay, so we have the one that should be getting the most sun. Frankly, it has sun on all sides but one, is pretty much naked trunk all the way up.
Well, then that's dead, Jim. No, it would not be abnormal for one tree out of a bunch like that to go dead. Maybe something's happening underground. Maybe it just got depressed. Blue spruces are, first of all, they're not native to Pennsylvania, you realize.
Right.
These things really are from the West. They're slightly unnatural here, and they're probably not enjoying the new climate that they're experiencing here. But there are two ways to propagate these plants. One is by seed. So you're looking for pine cones. Are there any pine cones left on the trees from last fall?
There are pine cones left, but they're, way out of reach. They're four stories up. Now, when it drops them on the ground, is there a way to tell which are the good pine cones from which are the ones you don't want?
Oh, yeah. It should be still kind of closed up tight, but very mature looking. And then you would let it dry out and you would harvest the seeds. Now, I'm no expert on this type of propagation. The seeds may need a cold treatment. They may need a little bit of scarification, something like that. Or you may just be able to plant them in a pot and nurture them along. But blue spruces are notoriously slow growers. You're not going to get anything that looks like a tree for 10, 12 years.
Understood, but it's more symbolic to give everybody a piece of these trees.
Yeah.
And there was another way you said also of potentially propagating them?
Yes, but again, you need to get up there and get the lushest green growth.
Okay.
Now, the reference book that I'm looking at out of my left eye is saying you want to take those cuttings in the fall. So that's what we would call hardwood cuttings as opposed to softwood cuttings. Either way, it sounds like you're going to need a cherry picker if you want to do this. You would get up there and get the growth that was the youngest and lushest this season that you could reach, cut off branches of that. And then typically with hardwood cuttings, what you would do is you would tie them together with a string and dig a little hole and bury them for the winter and then dig them up and try to root them in the spring. And that's just the same as with a lot of other cuttings. You get a pot of soil-free mix. You use a pencil to make little holes in it. You put your cuttings into the holes. You fill it in with more soil-free mix. You water it well. You put a plastic bag over it for humidity. You light a couple candles to the Blessed Mother. Or if you want, depending on your knowledge base and where you live, give the cuttings to a nursery or an experienced nurseryman. and they will get them along much better, have a much higher survival rate. One thing that is true of blue spruce is they tend to look like each other. There's not a lot of diversity. I think the honor would be the same if you bought like a nice Christmas tree sized one with its roots all balled up and burlapped and planted them in your own landscape in honor of your grandparents or both. You know, you can try taking the cuttings and germinating the seeds. You'll find lots of advice online and in books on plant propagation. Again, I would get the material to an expert, someone at a local nursery that actually grows their own plants, or ask at your local extension office if there's a plant breeder in the area, somebody who's crazy for propagating plants. I got to be honest, it's going to be 12 years before you have anything that really resembles what you're trying to get.
No, well, I understand it's not going to be a replacement in the yard, but rather it's something to comfort everybody who doesn't want to see grandma and grandpa's trees go away. So send everybody their seedling and let them worry about it. But excellent. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Betts.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will present a Titanic Talk on tomatoes on Saturday, May 13th, during the big annual plant sale at the Seed Farm in Emmaus, PA, in the Lehigh Valley. And then I'll go back to the Lehigh Valley to appear at the Allentown Library on Wednesday, May 24th at 7 p.m. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with Growing Wild Violets Indoors and more of your wild phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will delve into an intriguing question. Is there a way to grow those beautiful, ephemeral, absolutely gorgeous wild violets indoors? We'll talk about it after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Karen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Karen.
How are you?
I'm here. How are you?
I'm fine.
And where is Karen Fine?
LaFountain, Indiana.
What can we do for Karen in Indiana?
Well, I'm being invaded by wasps, and it seems like they're getting worse every year, progressively. This year, it's kind of early in the game of wasps, but they're swarming the house, and now I'm infested in my shed. And I don't know what to do. It's very uncomfortable being on my deck. I try to get rid of those paper wasps when I can. I also realize they do good things for nature, but I don't want them near me.
Okay, yeah, you pose an interesting question. Wasps like paper wasps, mud dauber wasps, perhaps hornets who build big nests. These are tremendous pest controllers. They take care of pest caterpillars the old-fashioned way. They just rip them in half and eat them. But unlike our native bees that often nest near our homes, these wasps can become aggressive. And wasp nests inside of a shed could become a problem because you need to get in and out of there, right?
Right. I need my lawnmower. I want my bicycle. And it's kind of scary to open the door.
Well, I'll tell you what I have done. We have a really nice balcony outside of our bedroom. In 1 year, hornets built one of the Warner Brothers cartoon hornet nests up in the peak at the top. And my wife was worried about it, but I felt pretty comfortable they weren't going to come down near us. And I was correct. And the nest looked great up there. It was like a decoration. But we also have these kind of outdoor sconce lamps that are open at the bottom. And paper wasps always go in there and make their nests. So one time we had to have people out on the balcony. And I hated to do this because, you know, they're not bothering anybody. But it's really simple. You just get a can of nonstick cooking oil, pressurized, like Pam.
Okay.
And you spray it directly on to the nest. Insecticidal oil is a great non-toxic way to get rid of pest insects. It coats their bodies, they smother, they certainly can't fly. And then, you know, when they're all gone, you or a helper can reach in there with a stick and knock the rest of the nest out. Probably the same thing in the shed. You want to do this when the weather is really cool, and you probably want to have a couple of helpers and really soak the thing. Other than that, I remember having a long conversation with Linda Gilkinson, who is an entomologist up in the Canadian provinces. And we talked about this, that it was a home with a sting-allergic person, and paper wasps and mud dauber wasps kept coming back and building new nests in kind of the same spot year after year. And she said science has been trying to figure out why they do these things, why they pick a spot, and nobody can figure it out. But it occurs to me now that one thing you might do is on the far side of the shed or on the walls of the shed where you don't have to come and go, put up, I guess it almost would be the equivalent of a wasp nesting box, you know, because you're always going to have them around there. But if you give them something that's open at the bottom and closed at the top, that you're never going to go near, then there's no issues between you and them. And that way you could have the pest control aspects, but make it easier for them to build there instead of in the shed. And, of course, you also know you have to close up the holes in the shed that they're going in.
Well, that's going to be hard to do because it's old and cranky. The doors are cranky.
Yes, no, as am I. But that's the basic answer, is you can try, like carpenter bees, you can try to give them a better place to live than the place you don't want them to. And I don't like killing insects in general, especially insects like this. But in this case, you are correct. If they are nesting right near you, they can be aggressive. When I had my greenhouse, they loved to build nests all through it. And they were not reluctant to sting. So when you see a nest getting started, you know, even though we don't want to do it, I would say go out there with that cooking oil spray and take care of them at a very early stage. And, you know, maybe then don't knock the nest down, because if it's soaked with cooking oil, it's going to be repulsive to them and they might find better places in the wild. And again, you've taken care of the problem, but you have not exposed yourself to any chemical toxins or anything like that.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Karen.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Oh, I can't believe we just hung up on Karen, because now I'm remembering Haint Blue, the special color paint that you can paint something with that's supposed to keep wasps from nesting there. So, Karen, when you're listening to the show, if you're still hearing me, or somebody call Karen and tell her, go to our A to Z archives at youbetyourgarden.org, click on H for Haint Blue, and read about all the research that's been done that shows that this color blue really does repel wasps. Wish I had thought of that 5 minutes ago. Darn. 1-888-346-9499. Francis, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yeah, hello, Mr. Mike. This is Francis from Media, in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
How are you today?
I'm here, man.
Good. That's, I don't know how I am and how I'll be, but it will depend on the answer to my problem. So this is my situation. In my backyard, I have bamboo-type weeds. They're green stem with thousands of little reddish dots, leaves on the sides. They're long, hollow. They break very easily. As a matter of fact, I removed the roots a few weeks ago. They were just starting to sprout up, and they've already grown 8 inches. And they're multiplying, I tell you, like the stars in the firmament. So I'm a little desperate because I've dug out the roots, which are thick, heavy, massive. And I thought I had solved my problem once and for all. But I guess this was an illusion because they seem to have resurrected and they're back with a vengeance. I've even used weed be gone on the leaves, but instead of killing them, I think I've encouraged their growth and their spread. So I am desperate.
Yes, and you probably hurt yourself using that stuff. I can tell you, of all the calls we've gotten on the show and all the emails, what, it must be 80% of the people call us after toxic herbicides don't work. We don't get many people saying, I sprayed an herbicide on a plant and it did work. No, those things are overrated. Now, when you pulled up the root systems, did it come up easy?
No, because they were very thick and intricate. I thought I would have the root right under that stem that I had. But as I dug and dug, it was very big. It was I had to hold it with both hands.
Okay, so I'm guessing, without any kind of knowledge or picture in front of me, that you might have Japanese stilt grass, which is very common in poorly kept lawns. Now, this is in a lawn, I'm presuming.
No, no, it's not a lawn. It's just a messy place.
Oh, okay. Well, then, right. Well,
but they do grow a little bit on my lawn, just a little bit, because they've spread. But they're otherwise on a messy and kind of, they border my property. There's nothing of importance there.
Okay. So the first thing you have to do is you have to go to a good home supply store and get really deep edging. And you want to pound this into the ground where they're starting to encroach on your lawn. Now, you've already pulled the root systems out, so you know how deep the rhizomes go. That's as deep as you want to go with a little lip left up above the soil. The higher the divider you start with, the more protection you'll get. And then on the other side, it sounds like what I would advise is going out with a lawnmower and every day for like 10 days, just scalping it down to bare earth. I mean, really, this is one time you want to see dirt blowing out the back of the lawnmower. And then I would have a big load of arborist wood chips and just spread it like 6 inches thick on top of the area where you want this stuff to be gone. And leave it on for like a year or two. And then after that, after you remove it or spread it out or something like that, if you see little shoots of it coming up, just be prepared with a flame weeder. It's got a little propane bottle on the one side, a shepherd's hook, flame comes out the other end. Guys love using them. But, you know, as long as it's in that wild area next to your house, it's always going to be coming over. So eventually, if you want to stop it, you're going to have to do something at that intersection as well. You're going to have to drive in deep edging. A professional landscaper can install what's called rhizome barrier, and that would guarantee to keep it out of your property. It's used to control running bamboo, and if it can control running bamboo, it can control Japanese stilt grass, which is not an uncommon, quote, lawn invader in our area.
So I have a question. So since I thought I had removed all the roots.
No, no, no. It's like horseradish. You leave the least little bit behind, and it'll germinate.
That's what must have happened, because I toiled and I thought I'd removed everywhere there was a root.
No, what you want to do, what you want to do is scalp it down repeatedly. Keep, and especially if you can keep doing this into the hot and sunny part of the season, just scalp it down. You'll be exhausting some of the energy in the root systems as it tries to regrow, and then smother it with a really deep mulch for a year or two. But again, you got to keep it from coming in because it's always going to creep sideways unless you put in a barrier.
Right. So I've got to exhaust these plants, hopefully before I get exhausted.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. I do appreciate your advice.
All right. Good luck, friend.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Can you grow violets, wild violets, indoors? Alexis Landis, get us started with this week's intriguing question, if you please.
Sure, Mike. Cynthia in Nashville writes, every spring, like right now, a portion of our lawn is a carpet of wild violets. I love it, but our landlord doesn't. He hates all flowers and wants a sterile lawn. He's so bad that when a neighbor planted flowers that climbed up her trellis, a feat she accomplished with only one hand, she came home to discover that he'd ripped out the flowers and trashed the trellis. To the point, I love plants, especially violets. Is there a way to grow them indoors? Once the lawn is mowed, they'll be gone until next year. I see questions in your archives from people who want to get rid of them. Why? They're so very beautiful.
Well, I had just come inside from picking a pint of wild violet flowers for my wife when Cynthia's plea arrived, so I just had to pick it for this week's question.
You pick them for Kathy to eat, right? Just like pansies.
Yep. All members of the viola family, that's wild violets, Johnny Jump-Ups, true violas, and pansies, are edible. And they're the best food source of rutin, a hard-to-find nutrient that strengthens your capillary walls and thus reduces or prevents the disfiguring look of varicose or spider veins.
You've been growing pansies for your wife, Kathy, ever since you learned that.
Yeah, as a health reporter. You know, at first, back then, the plants were only available in the spring. But then special winter pansies, icicle pansies, started showing up in garden centers in the early fall.
Right, but they're the exact same plants you'd buy in the spring.
Indeed, yes, pansies are pansies. Those fall plants were just started in the summer by growers, as opposed to the winter. But it's a much better deal to buy them in the fall. In most climates, they're going to flower all fall, survive the winter, and bloom again the following spring.
Until, quote, summer heat does them in.
Ah, that is correct, oh wise one. Pansies are super cold hardy, but like peas, lettuce, and spinach, they are cool weather plants that are going to burn up, or in some cases bolt, in the summer heat.
But the wild violets currently adorning our landscapes have a different life cycle.
You know, yes and no. Wild violets appear in the spring and last a month or two, depending on the weather. Like spring bulbs, the cooler the air, the longer the flowers are going to last. Then, just like pansies, they vanish when the weather gets too warm. But unlike pansies, which are true annuals, wild violets are herbaceous perennials that retreat to the safety of their underground root systems in the off-season, sometimes reappearing for a little show in the fall. Now, that's not every fall, and it's never as big a show as you get in the spring, but I generally get enough in the fall to decorate more than a few salads.
It sounds like our listener in Nashville only wants them for their looks.
Which is good, because in her situation, I would not advise any eating. If her landlord is a real weed-fighting fiend, he's likely to be dousing that turf with massive amounts of herbicides.
Which wild violets are essentially immune to, right?
Oh, yeah. Those fragile-looking pretty little flowers are unaffected by any herbicide a homeowner can legally buy. And there's no need to attack them. They are ephemeral. They provide beautiful color in the spring, food for humans, and caterpillars that become beautiful butterflies and then disappear after a month or two.
Okay, now, are you going to attempt to answer her actual question or just keep dancing?
You wound me! And I do know all the moves, ain't too proud to beg. But anyway, the best answer is to buy pansies and grow them in a window box or some other kind of container. Pansies come in all different shapes and sizes, and the small flowered ones look a lot like wild violets.
And if she has no outdoor space?
If she has the table room, she can grow a flat of small flowered pansies under a 4-foot-long shop light or one of the new LED plant lights that are coming out. Either way, look for lights that produce the most lumens. And, you know, pansies could actually live longer indoors because they're going to be protected from the summer heat. You just have to make sure you pick their flowers promptly.
Because a plant whose flowers are faithfully picked will keep pumping new ones out. But what about wild violets? Can she grow those indoors?
You're not going to let me get away from this, are you? Well, we know from our friends at the Philadelphia Flower Show that you can grow pretty much any plant at any time of the year if you got the resources. And what's to lose? Wild violets have large underground root systems. If she digs up a big clump and pots it before Vlad the Impaler gets to the lawn, it might well bloom inside if given the right conditions.
And then?
Well, it's hard to say what those wildflowers are going to do in the summer and the winter if they're indoors under bright light and in cool air. But it sure sounds like a fun project. And if they go dormant and you keep the greenery alive, they should rebloom at some point. Just don't let that landlord see you digging them up and leaving a big crater in his precious lawn. Well, those sure were some interesting ideas about wild violets, now wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to violate my violas if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. To be considered for a response, please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you're going to find the answers to all those questions you were going to send us, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Lunes, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work. And please like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz make our website wild. Our production assistant is Brett the Viking Raider. Spring blooming Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Untamed Al Banks is our editor. I'm the wild man of Glenlock Street, Mike McGrath, and I'll swing back to see you again next week. Want to grow twice as much in half the space with half the work? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll celebrate square foot gardening, the great Mel Bartholomew's method of growing in grids and raised beds, plus answers to all your growing questions.